Good morning. Good morning, one and all. Let me be the very first to wish you a happy Enlightenment Day. Am I the first? Some of us may be feeling a little grumpy because of a lack of sleep or didn't get that much sleep. And some of us maybe got lots of sleep and feel a little grumpy. Yeah. You know, grumpy is okay. As long as you know you're grumpy. It's when you don't know you're grumpy that things get out of hand. You know, knowing you're grumpy, it's kind of like Oscar the Grouch. You can kind of like laugh at the grumpiness a little bit. But I hope, you know, through our practice, we, when we're grumpy, we're a little aware of it and treat it with a kind of a kindness and gentleness. And certainly today, particularly for those who did sit yesterday, you know, to treat yourself with some kindness. Give yourself some slack. And know that whatever you're feeling, tired, grumpy, enlightened, that will pass. And something different will come in its place, and that's just our human condition. So somehow it's my turn to talk about what is really impossible to talk about, the nature of awakening that Siddhartha experienced. And what it has to do with us 2,600 years later, after his enlightenment, and half a world away from his homeland. What am I going to say? And, you know, and really, to make matters worse, Zen teachers have the very strong tradition of never talking about enlightenment. At least, that's what they say. Well, they never talk about it. Although, really, when I look at the Zen literature, much of it involves situations of awakening, right? They have all these stories about awakening, but they never say what the heck it is. You know, many of those traditional koans end with a monk awakening, right? You know, fingers raised, a shout given, a whack on the side of the head, and some kind of strange, enigmatic reply is given to a Dharma question. Suddenly, in that instant, the student was enlightened. And then the story stops, right? That's it. I remember when I first lived in Japan, I studied Aikido, living with my teacher. And my old Aikido teacher practiced Zen quite diligently under two Zen teachers, one Rinzai teacher and one Soto teacher, and he would leave every week and often spend overnight studying with them through the night. Very mysterious, actually. But several times during my stay in Japan, he said to me, especially I remember once sitting in a coffee shop, he said, the difference between awakening and delusion is as thin as a piece of rice paper. And I replied, yes? But in the good Zen tradition, he would never say more, leaving it to me to figure out whatever I was going to figure out. And I'm grateful now. I wasn't then. But I'm grateful now they didn't fill my head with tales of enlightenment experiences or kind of give pedantic explanations about what enlightenment is or awakening is, because that would have been no help at all. And yet to have no vision, however hazy, is not really helpful either. Yesterday, Kate described a bit of the long journey that Siddhartha had undertaken before he sat under the Bodhi tree. And much of it, you know, is perhaps like your life. And not that you were the son or daughter of a king, but really most of us have had fairly comfortable lives, at least physically as we grew up. You know, enough food, warm clothing, education, maybe medicine when we were ill, and protected, I hope, from most outside dangers. And just like Siddhartha, we were entertained with our virtual storytellers, like TV. We heard, you know, music on our Sony Walkman, or then, just as in the story of Siddhartha, something arises in our life. Some tragedy, some loss, or maybe some growing discontent with our circumstances, and we become more and more aware that the world is not as we wish it to be, that we cannot make the world give us what we want, and we cannot make the world take away what we don't want. Perhaps we come to see, at least for moments, our life for what it really is, largely out of our personal control. And so we begin the long journey, like Siddhartha did, looking for answers to questions that maybe we cannot even articulate, but we know we must seek and bring forth courage and fortitude to do so, just as Siddhartha did when the first practices he took up that Kate mentioned yesterday did not prove fruitful. This is really what I admire most about Siddhartha. He had a profound patience and great courage to keep on questioning, to keep on seeking. He didn't go back to the palace and indulge again in good food, music, dancing girls. He didn't give in to the seduction of kingship. And one of our challenges is not to give in to the seduction of the material world, not to believe the messages of all the advertisements that flood in into our eyes and ears. Those advertisements that say our life's meaning and happiness is to be found in acquisitions, in iPhone 6 Plus. If you have iPhone 6 Plus, you are cool. Or designer jeans. You know, I asked my students, I teach at SFU, and I asked my students, because I was doing this course on popular culture, I said, how many people here have an iPhone? And about half, maybe a little over half, put up your hands. And I said, how many people here have, like, it's iPhone 4 or 5, or, you know, and most people put up their hands, you know, who have the iPhone. And then I said, well, how many people here really want iPhone 6 and don't have it yet? And almost everybody put up their hand. That's Mara. That's the Mara Kate talked about yesterday. Siddhartha, after the visits of Mara that Kate described for us yesterday, and after the various temptations and delusions had finally quietened in him, Siddhartha continued to sit and entered deeply into the truth of reality of his life. He meditated for 7 days, and throughout the last and seventh night, according to the sutras, it went like this. Sorry, I'm just looking for my tea. It's not. So I'll there's a quote from the sutra here. So it went like this. This is the Buddha speaking. I truly made effort and endeavor. My thought was firm and undistracted. My body was tranquil and passive, and my mind was concentrated. I was free of desires and unwholesome thoughts. In this manner, my mind became concentrated, purified, cleansed, without defilement, pliable, established, and unmovable. So after his years of practice and after his long sitting, the 6-7 days of sitting, at last, for Siddhartha, the conditions for seeing the nature of reality are present. And Siddhartha's mind and heart settled. He was undisturbed by worry or judgment, and he was focused. He was completely present with his life. And then he really directed his attention, his concentration toward his own life. And he said, when my concentrated mind was thus purified, when it had become malleable, wieldy, steady, I directed my mind to the knowledge of recollection of past lives. That is to say, 1 birth, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 births, 20 births, 30 births, 40 births, 100 births, 100,000 births. Many ages of world contraction, many ages of world expansion. Dot, 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 dot. Thus, with the details and particulars, I recollected my manifold past lives. According to tradition, throughout the first watch of the night, Siddhartha gained insight into the arising and passing away of himself. He saw former lives and came to realize the consequences of his speech, thoughts, and actions that had led him to the present moment. Now, in the Zen tradition, not much is said about reincarnation. We can find much more discussion about reincarnation in the Tibetan tradition. The Tibetan lineages often emphasize this particular kind of knowledge of past lives. But in Zen, we understand that what we call this life is not an unbroken thread, but is being born and dying every moment. What we conventionally call our life is really myriad lives that flash in and then out. The 2-year-old Michael, the 12-year-old, the 22-year-old, all those Michaels are gone. The Michael that was angry yesterday was happy last week, frightened at a near car accident last month, is gone. All things are being born and dying moment by moment. Truly seeing this is our freedom, as there is nothing to hang on to. Truly seeing this teaching is to really know love, because by really loving, we let each thing really be what it is, and then let it go. So that was the first watch. Anyone experience that last night? It was here. That show of hands. During the second watch, of the night. Siddhartha directed his mind to the lives of others, and he saw the arising and falling of all living beings according to the results of their karma. He saw the shape of all life and the unfolding of reality. Buddha speaking again. When my concentrated mind was thus purified, I directed my mind to the knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings. I saw beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, happy and unhappy in their destinations. I understood how beings pass on according to their intentions. Notice that last word, intentions. All arises and passes away according to causes and conditions, right? Basic physics. All things arise and pass away according to causes and conditions. One of those causes is karma. The Buddha is really clear in many other texts that there are many forces that shape and affect us. A karma is but one. Karma, the Buddha said, arises from cetana, the Pali word meaning volition or motivation or intention. And as the Dhammapada, one of the really early texts, emphasizes about this idea of motivation or volition, it emphasizes the first poem that appears in this text called the Dhammapada. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, just as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows, like a shadow that never departs. In other words, one's life situation can be transformed by transforming the motivations of your actions here and now. And this too is the foundation of our freedom according to the Buddhist tradition. We cannot change our present circumstance magically somehow. But we can plant wholesome seeds for our future. So much more to say, but we're only in the second watch here. We've got another one to go. Finally, during the third watch of the night, Siddhartha saw the morning star rise. Morning star, of course, being Venus. And his mind became illuminated. Again, the Buddha speaking. When my concentrated mind was thus purified, I had direct knowledge as it actually is, that this is suffering, that this is the origin of suffering, that this is the cessation of suffering, and that this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. During this watch, Siddhartha realized the dependent arising of all existence. He fully understood what he later called the Four Noble Truths, the nature of dukkha, dissatisfaction, the cause of its arising, the cessation of its arising, and the path that leads to the cessation, which today we call the Eightfold Path. He understood the nature of non-self. And again, in his own words here, when I realized this, my mind was free from desire. My mind was free from ignorance. And as I became free, I realized I was free. This was the third wisdom attained at the end of the night. Ignorance was destroyed. Knowledge arose. Darkness was destroyed. Light arose. At this moment, Siddhartha became the Buddha, the awakened one. And according to the Zen tradition, he said, "I and the great earth and all beings simultaneously achieve the way. I and the great earth and all beings simultaneously achieve the way." Who is I speaking here? Who is this I? Is it Siddhartha? Is it the voice of a newborn baby? Is it the mountains and rivers? Is it you? Is there anything left out of this I? And what's he talking about anyway? I and the great earth and all beings simultaneously achieve the way. Perhaps Siddhartha, in becoming the Buddha, did not lose anything or gain anything. Perhaps he just saw clearly what has always been. One of the images of awakening that I have found really helpful is that of the ocean and wave. Maybe you're familiar with this. It's common in all Buddhist traditions, I think. At least I've seen it talked about in the Chinese tradition and Tibetan tradition. But there's a nice quote from Thich Nhat Hanh that kind of explains this image pretty simply. He says, "Enlightenment for the wave in the ocean is the moment the wave realizes it is water." Isn't that cool? I think it's kind of cool. Enlightenment for a wave in the ocean is the moment the wave realizes it is water. Let me talk about this a little bit. Dogen Zenji, the guy who brought our school of Zen from China to Japan and wrote many texts, Dogen Zenji, in a text called the Genjo Koan, writes that we can be confused about our life, and we only see it from a very narrow perspective. And he uses, again, this water imagery to help us understand this. So let me read you a quote from the Genjo Koan. "When you sail out in a boat to the middle of the ocean, where no land is in sight, and view the four directions, the ocean looks circular and does not look any other way. But the ocean is neither round nor square. Its features are infinite in variety. It is like a palace. It is like a jewel. It only looks circular as far as you can see at that time. All things are like this. In order to learn the nature of the myriad things, you must know that although they may look round or square, the other features of oceans and mountains are infinite in variety. Whole worlds are there. It is so not only around you, but also directly beneath your feet, or in a drop of water." We are not just a wave, separate. We are not just circular. We are not just a man or a woman, not just a struggling student, a constantly tired parent, a lawyer, a hopeless cook, a person with an aching back. We are infinite in variety. We are an ocean, vast, deep, full of life, and in constant change. Thich Nhat Hanh and Dogen are telling us awakening is really awakening to the ocean. The wave awakening to its water nature, inseparable from the ocean. When we begin our practice, we may think awakening is our goal. Somewhere in a far-off distance, I'm going to get there. Some distant place, some distant time. But Dogen corrects that misconception, and he poses the radical view that there is nothing but awakening. It's not a goal or the endpoint of our practice. In the same text, Dogen writes, "A fish swims in the ocean, and no matter how far it swims, there is no end to the water. A bird flies in the air, and no matter how far it flies, there is no end to the air. Know that water is life and air is life. The bird is life, the fish is life." And Dogen tells us the place of awakening is here. It has never been anywhere else. That the time of awakening is this present moment. It has never been at any other time. Somehow, we see ourselves only as the wave. We have lost or forgotten somehow our vast, limitless ocean-like nature. But we are never apart from it. The difference between awakening and delusion is as thin as a sheet of paper. There's a poem about this enlightenment and our life that Dogen Zenji wrote that I'll read next that maybe will help confuse you even more. And it goes like this. Awakening is like the moon reflected on the water. Awakening is like the moon reflected on the water. The moon does not get wet, nor is the water broken. Although its light is wide and great, the moon is reflected even in a puddle an inch wide. The whole moon and the entire sky are reflected in one dewdrop on the grass. Awakening is perhaps not what we anticipate. Not what we imagine. Perhaps it has always been here, intimate with us all along, like the beating of our hearts or the in and out of our breath. Some experience awakening as lightning and thunder, which makes for great stories. But I think most experience awakening more gradually. As the Zen master Yishan said, it is like walking in a mist, unaware that your clothes are getting wet. I think the gradual awakening makes for great poems. Although its light is great and wide, the moon is reflected even in a puddle an inch wide. The whole moon, the entire sky, are reflected in one dewdrop on the grass. When I was writing this talk and I came down to this part, I remembered Walt Whitman's famous quote. In his poem, A Song of Myself, he has that one line. I'm sure you've all heard it. I am large. I contain multitudes. I am large. I contain multitudes. So the Buddha continued to live and teach until he was an old man, somewhere in his 80s. And there are many stories about his teaching. And I hope that the story that you've heard during this retreat of the Buddha's awakening will be of some aid in your own journey. If for no other reason but to know that you're not alone, that you're part of a long lineage of those who have made a journey to awakening, awakening to their true vastness of being. And if I have confused you about all this stuff, then I've done my job. If you think you understand, maybe I've made a mistake. So, in a little bit, we're going to do something very unzen-like. We dance around, sing songs, and drink beer.
Ooh, beer this year.
But for now, let's again just kind of enter and enjoy a little more of the quiet. Allow the awakening just to come a little more present into our lives, however it manifests itself.
May our intention